frankly, that's all the introduction I like. Here's our speaker. Years ago, just before my relapse, and one of the things that presaged my relapse after about a year in the program, am I on? Yeah? I was asked to speak at a meeting, and I asked, how long do you want me to speak? I did very well. About a year in the program, lost a lot of weight, and pretty talkative guy, as you may have noticed. And they said, you can talk as long as you want. I talked for 45 minutes to an hour. And after that meeting, people came, oh, God, you were wonderful. Thank you. I learned so much. But deep in my heart, I knew that I had not been speaking from my heart. I was repeating things I had said at other meetings. I was acting again. And when I look back, that was the beginning of a relapse. And so I never, ever, ever want to be a star. I know is the moment I become a star is the moment I begin to relapse. And I don't want to do that. So I like just being introduced like that. And I also want to thank you all so much for having me here. I mean, as I said today when I was talking about Step 12, and I'll say tomorrow when I talk about Step 12, you are probably helping me more than I'm helping you. It's been wonderful preparing for this. It's been wonderful doing this. I'm exhausted, but I feel great. So I want to thank you. Because I did this mini big book study, that is the last time I hope to mention the book today, because I want to be sure that I keep this as a keynote speech much more general than that, even though I reserve the right to refer to AA history as helpful to us, but I won't necessarily refer to that book again. I am a thumper of that book, but I do not necessarily hold that it's the only way. I mean, there's some people who say, if you don't do it the way the first 100 did it, you'll never have it the way the first 100 had it. And I know that's not true, because I've met so many people who are in my humble estimation, far more serene than I am, far more committed to their program, who are just incredible fonts of wisdom, and they've hardly cracked it open, or they certainly didn't work the steps that way. So I want to talk about the steps in a more general way. I talked about steps 1, 2, and 3 yesterday as sort of the beginning steps, the steps where we understand what our problem is, we understand what our solution is, step 1 and step 2. We feel despair, we feel hope, we feel powerless, we hope to have power. That's steps 1 and 2. I don't know if I did say that I think that it's at step 1 that the one thing we do is adopt a plan of eating. All the AAers take for granted, almost every 12-step group takes absolutely for granted that you begin with abstaining from that which causes your problem, and then you work from there, because you then get clean, and then you work on, and you work the steps. I don't know, I mean, I can tell you from my own personal experience, not from me, but from a friend of mine who's no longer with us, who knew more about the big book than I'll ever know. He was a member, I'd mention the name, but he knew more than I ever would know about the program. He'd been a member of AA and NA and OA, and he asked me to help him through the steps. And I said, well, Faith, let's get a plan of eating. I can't do it. I just can't do it. I'm not abstinent. I can't do it. I said, well, what would you say to an AA sponsoree if he said, I'm just not going to, I can't stop drinking, but let's work the steps. I have to translate what he said into study. but you can imagine. He said, I'd tell him to shut up. You know, I can't take him to this. So I said, what do you want me to say to you? He says, please. So we worked through the steps together while he was not abstinent. And he said he had never done such a powerful step 4 and 5, and he made some amends. And he never recovered. And the sad thing is that at his funeral, he had committed suicide, and he had broken his abstinence, he had broken his sobriety, and I don't know what they call it in GA, but in NA he had broken his sobriety. And in that room, at the funeral thing, there were 400 people from OA, AA, and NA who would have dropped anything they were doing if he had just called one of us, because we loved him. He was an incredible person. So for me, yeah, there may be some people around who have been able to get abstinent after working the steps, but I wouldn't recommend it as an experiment. So for me, step one is taking for granted that you figure out what you abstain from and you work the steps. Now, I would say this, that I would not, and I've said this to people I sponsor, I would not adopt a plan of eating unless I also adopted a plan of working the steps that had some sense of a time period in which I would be doing it. Because if I just work the steps, if I just get abstinent and I don't know what I'm doing and I'm not working the steps, my mind is going to bring me back to the same problem again. It's going to suggest to me that this time I can have a bit and it's not going to hurt me. I'm away from it for a long time and there's no problem. I'm going to get a suggestion from something or someone or some situation that's going to say to me, yeah, you can have some. And it can be the stupid mind of, they made it for me, or they bought it for me. How can I turn it down? Or it can be the very deep feelings of despair that I've often felt before I ate. But whatever it is, if I don't have a plan for working the steps, I don't have a sense of a timetable for saying, okay, I'm going to make my step five appointment and then work backwards from working my step five appointment, work backwards and figuring out how to do my step four. I would say that there's a real danger there. So for me, at least, and my experience in this program, it's relatively extensive. I wouldn't say it's as extensive as everyone in this room, but it's certainly relatively extensive, is that the people who recover in this program are people who work the steps as quickly and as directly as they can while being abstinent. So that's step one. Step two, the hope. And the hope is, you have something I want, help me. Tell me what you did, and I'll do what you did. And all around OA are people who are more than willing to do that and tell you what they did. That doesn't mean you have to accept exactly what they say, suggestions and all that. But it means that you should accept help where it's available, because you may be helping them more than they may be helping you, actually. Step three is just a decision. I discussed that last night. And it is just a decision. That's what the words say. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Doesn't say did anything. Just said made a decision to do something. And you know the old saw about the three frogs sitting on the log and two make a decision to jump off the log and 5 minutes pass, how many frogs are left? Three. Because they only made a decision. They didn't do anything. There's an old joke, and I do love this joke, so I will tell it, because the guy, there's a very devout spiritual man, or woman, doesn't matter, but I'll tell it like a man, has a favorite charity that's about to go bankrupt because someone stole its money, and it will be getting a lot of money shortly, in about 6 weeks, but for the next 6 weeks, if it doesn't get any money, it's gone. And he can't find any money. He doesn't have any money. He's a very devout man. So he decides to pray. And he gets on his knees in his little room, and he says, God, I've never asked you for anything for myself, and I'm not asking for you for myself right now. But I need to win the lottery next week. And I don't need to win the $1 million or the $45 million. I just need $100,000. And it's going to the charity. I'm not going to spend any of it. It's just going to the charity, a fine charity. And I'm going to eat bread and water only. I'm going to pray to you 18 hours a day for the next week. And he does that. And I can make it a lot longer, but I'm not going. He does that. He prays and prays and prays and prays and prays. And finally, he's on his knees. He says, it's Saturday. God, just two more hours to the lottery. Please, and he's praying. And it's beautiful and sunny outside. I guess this is not an experience that many of you have in Seattle, as I understand. I've been in the sun in Seattle for at least a minute. And at any rate, the sun, it's all bright and sunny. It's like Winnipeg, bright and sunny. Maybe cold, but it's bright and sunny. 40 below, but it's bright and sunny. It's a dry cold, that's what we say. And even the rain, when it rains, we say it's a dry rain. You know, but Anyway, so he's on his knees, he's praying, and suddenly the sky starts to darken. Clouds come in from nowhere, big, dark, black clouds. They just cover the sky. It's so dark that the streetlights go on because of, you know, the light sensors. It's dark. And suddenly he hears lightning. He hears thunder, but he can't see where any lightning is. It's just roaring and thunder. And suddenly a bolt of sunlight shines right through his curtains that are drawn. Well, they're not drawn, but it shines right through, right onto his face. And a frustrated voice says, "Buy a ticket." It's only a decision. What we have to do is take action. And that action consists of steps 4 through 9. The steps in which we identify and then get rid of the problems that we have, our defects of character, our shortcomings. And how do we do that? Well, I mean, there are many ways of starting step 4. There are many ways of doing it. And I'm not going to, at this talk about any specific way. But to make a searching and fearless moral inventory means that in some way we're looking at ourselves and looking at ourselves from a moral point of view. Now, a moral point of view would mean from the basis of our own conception of our higher power. You know, I talked about my conception is completely abstract. I'm agnostic. I have no personal God whatsoever. But in this program, I have a God. And it's truth, love, justice, and beauty. I was just talking about who was it who said that his higher power is Magic Johnson? Yeah. You know, whatever it is, and there are others who have a slightly more traditional view of what their God is, but whatever it is, it's from the standpoint of the morality of one's higher power, one's sense of what is most important, that we begin to take an inventory of ourselves. We begin to not judge ourselves, but look at what we are and what we do from the point of view of what we believe is best. And you know, I certainly, it became very clear to me that the things I believed in were not things I was doing. And that was part of my problem. And as I went through my inventory, and the way I did it is one way, but there are many, many different ways. By the way, here's an OA joke. How many OAers does it take to turn a light bulb? To screw a light bulb? Answer is, I've answered 170 questions, I'm not answering any more. I'm not sure. If you take offense from that, I'm sorry. It's too good a joke not to tell it. But anyway, moving right along. I'm looking at the sea of faces. I'm just looking for anyone who's darting dagger eyes at me. I hope not. I'm sorry. I hope it's all in good fun. But at any rate, however you do your inventory, do it relatively quickly, because otherwise you're going to relapse. I mean, that's the experience of so many people in this program. And so do it as quickly as you can. But whatever it is, you identify within yourself the things that are really keeping you and blocking you off from your higher power. And those are your defects of character, your shortcomings, your wrongs, the things that have happened to you in your life that are really, really troubling. Now, they may be things that you suffered as well as things that you created. And very often the things that you suffered are things that you continually recreate the suffering of. You know, certainly I've discovered that in a lot of my own very minor sufferings, and I certainly have discussed that with people who have truly suffered, because I don't think it's fair to say that I've really suffered a lot, although I certainly felt I suffered a lot. I mean, I'm a pretty sensitive guy, so a minor slight from someone is enough to send me into a tizzy, whereas other people have suffered truly in this program. Though I was once at a meeting, it was a very small, it was a meeting of about 10 people. It was a sharing meeting, and we all discussed some difficult things that were going on in our lives. And then we went out for lunch afterwards, an absent lunch, and we discovered that everyone at that table, because we were all there, every one of us felt sorrier for someone else than for ourselves after they talked. You know, what happened to me was nothing compared to what happened to you. And it was almost like a daisy chain all the way around. So that some people felt sorry for me, whereas I didn't feel that sorry for me. I felt sorry for someone else. So it may be that some of the things I've suffered have been difficult, but I certainly, in light of the suffering that some people have had, is just I don't think so. But what they have said to me, the people who have suffered greatly and have worked through this program and have recovered in this program, is that they continued to create their problem. They had their problem. It was in the past. Why have they continued to hold on to it? And that has been their own responsibility, holding on to it has been their responsibility. And the inventory process that they went through allowed them to see that and to deal with their issue. Now, the promise of this program, and found in some book or the other, is that our experience, we will find how our experience can be of benefit to others. You know, that was read yesterday. So someone said yesterday that we will find how our experience can benefit others. And those words are so important because it means that the bad things that have happened to us in our lives will become for us ways in which we can help others. And that gives meaning to it. I mean, some people who are more religious may believe that we went through those trials in order to be able to be of benefit. Others will simply say, I might as well put it to good advantage because it certainly isn't doing me any good in bad advantage. I might as well use it. But whatever it is, the recovery that we end up getting in this program allows us to take the things that we have suffered and help others with it. So in step four, we isolate those things. In step five, we share them. And that sharing is a wonderful thing. And those of you who have not experienced it yet may be very afraid of it. I'll never say that, you know, I'll never say something to anyone like that. You know, I remember I was sharing with some people that I did a step five with a sponsee, and she, I'm a lawyer, and she came in and gave me a dollar and said, now you're on retainer, you know, and you have to keep confidence, you know. And what I didn't tell her, because I kept a buck. No, I didn't. But what I didn't tell her was that, yeah, as a lawyer, I know how to keep confidence anyway. But even more important, as a human being, I forget everything after about 2 weeks. And, you know, people will do a step five with me and say, oh, Laurie, you remember how, you know, remember what I said? I said, no. Well, I may play along and say, oh, yeah, remember Frank? No, who's Frank? You know. But at any rate, and she said, she also said to me, you realize that at the end of this, I'll have to kill you. And she was only half joking. No, she was, because after about 3 hours, she shied away from one topic. And finally, at the end of it, I said, okay, are we done? This is amazing. This is really great. And it was really heartfelt and wonderful. She said, there's something else I have to tell you. Something else. And she told it to me. And for her, it had been a mark of shame that had been on her mind for 20, 25 years, whatever it was. And for me, it was something that I have experienced in my own life and that made it complete sense to me, and I understood it perfectly. And the relief that she had, well, I remember that same relief because I've had that same relief telling someone else these things. So what is step five for me? I mean, step five, if I don't do it, I'm going to die. But there are good reasons for doing it and reasons that should make anyone feel as if he or she would want to do it. You're connecting with another human being and you're confessing something that is deep for you. That's just as deep. Secondly, you're finding out that you're not alone, that everyone feels the same as you do. At least some people feel the same as you do. That you are not isolated in your own sense of what your life has been like. That their life has been similar to yours. Their feelings have been similar to you. I mentioned in the workshop today, Clancy, that the great AA speaker who talks about hearing a step five, and he draws a huge picture of, you know, he's driving the car and the rain is heavy rain. The windshield wipers are going back and forth in this. His sponsee is reading with a flashlight, you know, and then Clancy, I did this, and then I did that. And Clancy says something like, oh, does he know what I'm thinking? They're all the same. Why don't I get a murderer? You know, because we are all the same, you know, and we can all do these things, and we have all thought these things or done them, or we know that we could have done them if we had had the opportunity to do them. And so this sense of connection. And the last reason why step five is important, I think, at least in my experience, is to get feedback. is to get a sense of whether I'm being too difficult or too hard or too easy on myself. To help someone help me fill in some of the blanks that might be there where I don't really see my part in this. Because what's important is for us to see our part in the relationship, in the issue that we deal with. Even if someone's hurt us, what is our part in that? Where have we been at fault? So that's step five. Is so important, that connection. There's also another part of step five, which is, of course, admitting to God. And how you do that as well is a meditative moment where you're really saying to yourself, am I done? Have I finished this completely? How do I feel about this? Do I feel as if I've released everything that has to be released? And I, you know, those of you who have done it will know how wonderful it feels, and those of you who have not done it should know that it really is a wonderful thing. You should also know, by the way, that those of you who are just beginning, the experience of all of us who have worked the steps is, don't look ahead. Don't be at step one and say, oh my God, I'll never tell anyone about that thing at step five, so I better not do step two. You know, at each step, there's a reason for the steps being in the order that they are, and at each step, you will want to go on to the next. By the time you finish step four, you'll know why you want to go on to step five. You will see that. It will make sense to you. And by the way, if you don't, that's a measure of a step four that you should really think about. Because a step four really should make you feel as if you're ready to go on to step five. Step three, of course, you are ready to go on to step four because step three is making a decision to go on, right? So each step leads you on. And if you say, you know, I can't go on because I'll never apologize to that so-and-so at step nine, you may not have to apologize to that so-and-so. And you'll only apologize if you know it's going to be good for your soul and good for that person's soul, too. It won't do that person harm. It'll be good for your soul. So that's step five. Very simple. Very simple. If you know anything of the early history of AA, and you say you've read any of Bill Wilson's writings, you'll remember that when Ebby, his person he called his sponsor, the person who brought the message of the Oxford groups to Bill, went to see him and explained to him this program that he had discovered, what Ebby said was something really simple. He said, well, you know, you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make amends or restitution for the harm you've done, you trust in God and you help other people without hope of reward. And it was that simple. You know, all Bill did was add hopelessness, the need to reach your bottom. That's all he did. And there were six steps in the original program. And those are the steps that are really significant. When Bill wrote the 12 steps, he wrote them in order to make sure that they could be used by someone where there was no AA, where there was no one to sort of give the guidance that was available. But four and five, right there, you get honest with yourself, step four. You get honest with another human being, step five. All the rest of it is great, but that's the essence of what Ebby brought to him. And then you go through a process, Bill, put this in, step six and seven, a process, or as we say in Canada, process. process, yes. We went through a process of getting ready to have our defects of character removed. And six and seven, well, you could write long essays about them, but essentially six is willingness and seven is a sense of readiness. But it doesn't end there. And for me and my experience is that I've watched people wait at six until they're really, 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 really willing and they relapse. And I've watched people at seven wait until God has removed their defects before they make their amends and they relapse. And if there's anything I know about this program in any way I can assist you, it is to urge you to understand that the steps are a whole program. Some book says half measures avail us nothing. Well, 11/12 measures avail us nothing either. And the steps aren't suggested. It's the program that's suggested. It's all or nothing. And if you don't work the steps and wait for the steps to work on you, it's not going to do it. It's a program of action, not of contemplation. And we are, as compulsive eaters, I don't know where I said this, but we are relatively lethargic. I did talk about it yesterday. Relatively lethargic compared to the stereotypical alcoholic. And I think that lethargy sometimes really, because food is truly anesthetic to us. I mean, we get heavy. We can't walk easily. We just want to stay in one place. And I think that that transfers itself sometimes to our willingness to wait for something to happen rather than to go out and do something. But the real action takes place at 8 and 9. And for me, it's crucial. It was for me crucial, at least, to understand that that's what the real action is. That's the action of making up for the wrongs that we've done. And the brilliance of Bill to separate 8 and 9 was simply to make sure, instead of you go on, you make amends for what you've done, you make restitution, was to say, wait a minute, you better be sure, first of all, you're ready to make amends to everyone, but you better work out as to whether or not the amends you're going to make is going to hurt anyone other than yourself. Be ready to have it hurt yourself, but make sure that it doesn't hurt anyone else, because that would be unfair. You know, and I said this afternoon, I mean, the example that the OA 12 and 12 uses, I've always loved. It's, hey, Mom, I have to make an amends to you. I've hated you for 20 years, and I'm really sorry. And I've always thought that that kind of amend was not quite what was in the spirit of this program. Because that is an amend made at the expense of the person you're making the amend to. And, you know, I've talked about, you know, what I say to an ex-girlfriend, something like, you remember 40 years ago I didn't take you to that party, and you said it was because I was embarrassed to take you, and I said, no, it wasn't. Well, it really was, and I'm really, really sorry. And I am truly sorry, because I was stupidly looking at something else rather than at this person who was an incredible person whom I should have been proud to take to the party. But why in the world would I want to remind her of that moment? So the importance of understanding the difference between making an amend for my sake and making an amend in order to clean the street and is so important. But step 8 and 9 is our opportunity to become different people from what we were. The essence of an amend, it seems to me, is I am sorry for what I have done. I want to make it up to you however it is reasonable to make it up to you, or however it would put you back in the position that you were in before I did what I did. And I hope never to do that again, because I am now going on a different path. I'm trying to be a different person. And the more we do that, the more we become the different person who is not the person who did those things. That's a rebirth. That's a conversion experience. And it is why, for many of the AAers originally, they called it a spiritual experience and not a spiritual awakening. And then they changed it after the first edition, the first printing of the first edition of the big book in 1941. They realized everyone kept waiting for the sudden conversion experience that was similar to what Bill had and similar to the guy in that book that I won't mention the name of, Who Are You to Say There Is No God? You know, all those experiences. But they realized that the real and the most common experience was what they called the educational variety, that people gradually realized, and their friends realized before they did, that they had become different people. And that's the recovery that we look for, become different people. Many kinds of amends, and I'm not going to go into them in any great detail, but I just want to talk about, in general, the concept is that we make up for the harm that we've done. And we have to understand what the nature of that harm is before we can make up for it. And I give an example of, and I did this in the workshop, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to repeat this again when I said in the workshop, I'm sorry. For those who attended the workshop, I'm sorry I'm repeating myself, okay? But I'm not going to repeat myself too much. But what is the harm that I have done? I have some friends who have been victims of abuse. And the harm that they ultimately feel that they did, and I'm speaking from their experience, not my judgment of them, this is what they've said to me. They have a deep, deep, difficult stuff. Was when they had an opportunity as grown-up people, because they experienced as a kid, to be able to say something, they said nothing because they were too embarrassed about it and too ashamed and too hurt and all that. And they say to themselves, okay, what is the harm that I did to the person who committed this on me? And the answer that they give is, I allowed him to continue to do other people harm. And by doing harm to other people, he did harm to himself. Because anytime you hurt someone else, you become less of a human being. Anytime you can do something harmful and not think about it and not have remorse and not feel bad about it, you become less of a human being. And people go through their lives. The more hurt they do, the less of a human being they do. I had to go through this with Hitler. Because as a Jew growing up in the 50s, believe me, the whole atmosphere was charged with the Holocaust and the loss of so many lives, and not just Jewish lives, but the loss of so many lives, not as the result of a war, but as the result of a planned system of killing. And this sense, I mean, how Hitler weighed on me. I mean, as a kid, it weighed on me. I still have a huge library of Holocaust literature. How could this happen? And I began to realize it could happen to anyone at any time. Because we're all capable of cutting off our soul for reasons that are beyond our comprehension. We're able to do that. We do that when we walk past people who are suffering and say, no, I don't want to deal with them. They're drunk. I mean, watch people on a skid row and I can't deal with that. It's too much. We do it every day by, we have to do it in many ways. So many of us cut ourselves off. Those who did the actual harm did even more than that. They actually killed themselves as well. I think they did. And that's how I had to look at them. So what is the harm I did with Hitler? I did to Hitler? I let him gain control of my mind for a very, very long time. And he incapacitated me. My anger and my hurt and my frustration incapacitated me, and I could not be of as great a service as I could be to other people, because my mind was so mixed up that I was eating as a result of it, that I was not loving to my family, I was not loving to people around me, I was not a useful member of society in so many ways, because I didn't want things to happen that had already happened before I was born. So, what is the harm that we do? We really have to analyze this in order to make the amend. And so many of us in OA feel, I'm not saying we are, but we feel as if we're victims rather than victimizers. You know, I know that, and so many of us are. And I've met so many women in this program who, and I think they suffer even much more than many of the men, because so many, I mean, women, you know, the body image thing is such, it appears to be so much more important to women than to men in our society. And I've met so many women who became fat as a result of abuse in order to protect themselves from it, or who were abused because they were fat. So we are people as a group, as an OA group, we're people who have been victims. And where do we get off saying that we have done harm to those who've harmed us? Well, the answer is, in certain ways we have. We don't take responsibility for that, other than to say, I don't want to be the kind of person that's going to be like anymore. You know, there's a story about a woman who was horribly brutalized for 4 days by a man. Her arms were cut off. He wanted to kill her, but she was rescued, and she was interviewed 10 years later after the guy was caught and sent to jail. And she said, and she was asked, "Don't you hate that man?" She said, "That man took 4 days out of my life. I'm damned if he's going to take any more." And, you know, that whole sense of that's part of my past, it's not part of my present, is the kind of amend that we sometimes have to make to ourselves. That person's not going to get me anymore. I had that with a person, he's passed away now, but he's a lawyer who betrayed my trust and harmed my client as a result, and harmed me. And, of course, we were involved in a law case, and he had really cheated me. I mean, really and truly. And yet he was loved by people. He was a happy-go-lucky guy, and everyone loved him. And he was on my list. I had a case with him, and I couldn't think. I just wanted to kill him. And this is at my first year in OA. And I was working my inventory. I was working my step five, and what do I do? You know, well, you know that there's a passage somewhere that says that if we really resent someone, if we can't get over that resentment, we pray for that person to have what we want out of life. And I began to pray for this person to have what I want out of life. Well, to do that, I have to figure out what I want out of life. What do I want out of life? I want serenity. I want to be useful. I want to be able to love. I want to be able to be loved. I think that's about it in my life. Really, that's what I want. And when I said that prayer for people like Hitler and people like this lawyer, I won't equate them, I mean, but you know what I'm saying, but for a whole bunch of people, I began to realize that they had no life. They could not be loved. They were incapable of loving. They were never serene. They were living in a paranoid, well, Hitler would live a paranoid universe. This lawyer was living a lie. He knew he was a cheater and a liar, and everyone may have loved him and thought he was great, but he knew he wasn't. His kids didn't talk to him because of how he had treated their various mothers. So I began to realize that my life was being ruled by my feelings about other people who themselves were suffering human beings. And when I got to that point, I was able then to handle it. You know, and my friends, in terms of amends, my friends, I had three friends who were abused as kids, and one of them went to the police as an amend to stop the person from doing any more harm. One of them said, 92 years old, decrepit, dying, I don't need a thing. He's just off my case. He's gone from me. And the third one announced at a family gathering that this uncle is the person who committed incest with me, and I'm not letting my kids anywhere near him. If I were you, I wouldn't let them near him either. Three different solutions, each one perfect for that person. My sense of amends, you pray about it, you think about it, you work on it, you make sure that your motives are good. You make sure that you're looking out for the other person and not for yourself, that you know what your amend, you know what the harm you've done is, and you pray to figure out what kind of an appropriate amend would be. And then you also begin to think about, am I going to harm anyone as a result of that? And if you will, you don't do it. You're ready to do it, but you don't do it. And then there are also living amends that we have to make, because there's no way that we can make up for the harms that we've done to families without living differently. But whatever it is, it's all this sense of becoming a different person. We have that ability in our program. That's the gift of the 12-step programs, the ability to become different from what we were. And once we see that, and once we get that sense of that power in us, that comes directly from getting rid of the blocks between us and our higher power. It says, I no longer want to be the person who's in charge of my life. I want to be in charge of my life is my deepest core values. And I'm going to work to make sure that the harm I've done to others as a result of not living my life according to that way is undone as much as I'm humanly capable of doing. Then I'm able now to become directly connected and able to live that. So the other aspect then is that we're promised by some literature that at the end of step 9, actually by a lot of literature, OA literature and AA literature, that at the end of step 9, we will be free from the bondage of our food. You know, freedom from bondage, that whole sense that no longer do we need to go back to that stuff? We are sane human beings. That is the promise. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And what is sanity? Real simple. It's this sense of, this food is bad for me. I cannot indulge in this eating behavior because it will kill me. No thank you. I don't like it anymore. I don't want it anymore. It's just that very simple sense and that kind of freedom that is guaranteed by this program. That's why I came to OA. You think I came to OA to find God? I didn't come to OA to find God. I didn't come to OA to become a nicer person. I came to OA because I had a problem with eating and nothing else worked. And I didn't want to die. And my wife didn't want me to. Thank goodness my wife is not an enabler. She said to me, you'd better do something. I don't want the kids to see you die. I want you around when the kids are older, and you're going to die. And my friend Wally said, if you don't take your food as seriously as I take my alcohol, you're going to die. And I began to take myself seriously because I didn't want to die. I wanted to be around. So for me, this is a life or death program. So I came because nothing else worked. And the promise that I was given was that I could be around the foods that used to beckon to me and not want them. Well, that to me is a miracle. To be able to do that is an absolute miracle. And when I, one of the ways I can tell whether there's an OAer around, a potential OAer, is to say, is it a miracle to you, as I said yesterday, that I can watch my wife eat half a chocolate cake and be happy for her? Watch her not want to have a taste of it, even after she says it's the best chocolate stuff I've ever had in my life, and then not be angry at her when she says I can only eat half of it. And I consider that a miracle. So that ability to do that is what's promised in this program, and that's the first promise we should make clear to anyone in this program. Not that we'll be better people. That's nice. Pretty good. You know, I'm a pretty good person. I always thought of myself as a pretty good person. But and before I joined the program, I thought of myself as a pretty good person. I don't think I was, but I thought of myself that way. But what I came for was to be free from the bondage of food. I'll talk much more about that tomorrow, because I want to talk about the message that we actually give to potential members, that we actually give to ourselves. And I'll talk about that in the last speech I give. But we get this promise in step 9. We're freed. We've had a spiritual awakening. We're flying high. And then the problem is, how do we keep it? And for me, that has been the key, because I've achieved that plateau of finishing step 9 and feeling great about myself a number of times in my first 6 or 7 years of program. Each time I relapsed, I went back and doggedly did the steps again. And each time I doggedly did the steps again, I recovered and I felt great. And then I relapsed. And I felt great. I went back and did the steps and I relapsed. This happened over a period of 6 or 7 years. I guess by the end of the 6th or 7th year, I wasn't doing it as much. I was just sort of existing. I prided myself that, at least I hadn't gained all the weight back, you know. Actually, I don't even know if that's true, because I had stopped weighing myself. So I don't know how much I had lost, so how do I know how much I had gained? But I prided myself that at least I hadn't done that. I was probably 5 pounds under what I was when I started. And when I finally recovered completely 16 and a half years ago, and when I say recovered, because that is what I think we should be saying. I am different. I don't attribute it to myself. It's not a point of pride with me. I've recovered through nothing I've done other than to follow directions. But that's what people are looking for, recovered. Not, I must tell you, I mean, not recovering, which is sort of like a faltering kind of, I'm always working, you know, I don't know if I'm there or not. I'm there. I'm a different person from what I used to be. I'm not cured, but I've recovered. Cured but not recovered, as the trustee for Region 8 says. Yeah, recovered but not cured. Thank you very much. Yes. As a trustee for Region 8 says, I'm recovered but not cured. I'm a minute away from relapse, and I still am a minute away from relapse. How do I keep it? Well, when I finally recovered, I realized the mistakes I'd made for the last 6 or 7 years. The first mistake I made was that I had refused to accept that my body was different from normal people. I told you about this yesterday. I thought that along with every other diet program I had been on, I could take back those foods that I'd given up during the diet, and eat them in moderation. I didn't accept the notion that there were some foods I just couldn't eat. Well, that's a pretty good way to go on to relapse. My body took hold of me. But there was another aspect which I didn't even realize, and that's an aspect of an understanding of step 10 that I did not have for 6 or 7 years. The way step 10 is written, it says, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. But as I began to understand that step more, and this is the lesson that I learned, and once I learned that lesson, I never relapsed again. I mean, I would go through my steps. I'd get high, happy, not high, but you know what I mean, happy. It was step 9. I wouldn't get high. I got high on life. So my mother couldn't stand drugs, you know, and she had this way of saying, why don't you get high on life? You know, as sort of like try to be with it, you know, but not quite. anyway, I would finish step nine and I feel great. And I wouldn't necessarily go back to eating the other foods, you know, but still I would end up relapsing. And that was where the step 10 came in. Because what I began to realize is that step 10 goes beyond simply admitting my mistake. It is really that I'm repeating steps 4 through 9 again in the context of recovery, that I'm working it through again. I'm cleaning up my past because from, let's say, on May the 1st of 1993 is my date of abstinence. It's approximately that. I don't even know exactly when, but it's around the end of April, the beginning of May of 1993, as far as I can determine from some letters I wrote to some people. So let's say on May 1st of 1993, I finished my last amend and I felt great. I had cleaned up my past in an inventory, say, 2 weeks before. And I cleaned up my past. And now 6 months have passed, have gone on, P-A-S-S-E-D. I have 6 more months have passed now, P-A-S-T. I have 6 more months of history. And some things have happened in that 6 months or a year that have created more problems within me, more issues that I haven't dealt with. And I've got to deal with those. I have to clean up that past. I have to continue to clean up the past. Dr. Bob says, is reputed to have said, his prescription for life, for an alcoholic, is clean house, trust God, help others. That's steps 10, 11, and 12. I have to continue to clean house. Because if I don't continue to clean house, I will relapse. And that was my experience. I relapsed because I failed to continue to clean house. I read that step as saying, oh, when I do something wrong, I'll apologize. That's not it. Why am I doing these things wrong? When I yell at my kids, why am I yelling at my kids? It isn't because of them. It's because something else is going on in my life that I don't like. In my first couple of years in the program, I had to learn how to accept good things. I felt guilty because good things were happening to me, and I felt guilty because there were bad things happening elsewhere. That's weird, but that's very Jewish for those of you who are Jewish. John quoted Woody Allen as saying, Jews are born with guilt and Catholics have to go to school to get it. I don't know if that's really right, but it's not a bad joke. I've quoted Woody Allen twice, and my wife hates him, but where was I? Oh, I felt guilty being happy in a world that was sad. I mean, I had a... it's a big deal, you know. I mean, oh, poor Lori, right? That was the first year, and I was able to accept that. But in the next couple of years, some really difficult things began to happen in my family and my wife's family. Really, really hard things for us. Deaths and illnesses and things like that. And I wasn't dealing with them. I had cleaned up the past up to then, but I didn't deal with them. And when I was yelling at my kids and apologizing, I wasn't cleaning up my past. So what I learned after 6 or 7 years in this program was that step 10 is essential for understanding that I have to clean up my past on a continuous basis. Once I learned that, and I learned that I can't eat certain foods and indulge in certain eating behaviors, I have never broken my abstinence. I have not relapsed because I don't make the same mistakes. I say to anyone who relapses, okay, let's figure out what your mistake was and don't do it again. You know, it's an opportunity to learn. Our program is full of opportunities to learn. We learn from the mistakes we've made in order to become better people. That's what our program is all about. No guilt, no shame. Just become a better person by learning from what you've done wrong. So that's step 10 for me, and for me it's been a lifesaver. And step 11, well, for me it's become a very practical thing. A lot of meditations, a lot of things that we can do. And I used to have 5 meditation books. My wife kept buying me them. It was a good hint to me that maybe I needed something more than what these meditation books gave me. She kept hoping that I'd find something in those books that I guess would make me a little bit calmer. But they weren't, you know. And I'd read them all. And I'd read them and enjoy reading them and stuff like that. But in the end, they didn't do much good for me. Because, A, I wasn't dealing with my past, and B, I wasn't meditating in at least the very basic way that I think the program talks about. And that is thinking about how I'm doing and thinking about what I'm going to do in a way that I can give it up to my higher power. Think about, am I doing my best for others? Am I helping others? How did I do? And how am I going to do? and giving up my will and my life on a regular basis to the things that I believe in, and saying I can't act according to my will. I have to act according to the things I believe in. And for me, that's really quite essential. And I wasn't doing that very practical aspect of praying and meditating. I was simply thinking a lot about myself, because that's what I ended up doing. You know, how do I think about these things? And I had to, in an organized way, I had to deal with that. I'm not going to take much more of your time today. It's pretty late. It's getting hot in this room, and there's a talent show coming on. But for me, this sort of overview of 4 through 11, because I want to deal with 12 tomorrow, I want to deal with the message we give, I want to deal with traditions, and I want to confess to being a member of the traditions police, the secret organization that that some of us seem to be members of. The traditions police are those people who say, you can't do that, it's contrary to tradition 6.2, you know. And I've been a member of that force, and I want to talk about that. And I want to talk about the message we give, and I want to talk about toughness. And maybe I'll just preview that by talking about how I got out of my last relapse. I was in a group that had been formed as a sort of an adjunct to another group. I was in a wonderful group that met on a Tuesday evening, full of recovery. This is a group, some of you may have heard me talk about this group. I call it a soap opera meeting, because you'd go week to week to find out, did she break up with her boyfriend? Did he quit his job? It was fascinating, because we'd hear all these stories, but it was full of recovery, and these people were really working through their issues. But it was a fascinating collection of human beings, you know. But they had all suffered tremendously, and I was 40, successful in business, and you know, really happy family and kids, and I felt so guilty. You know, I mean, here I was, a member of this group, taken in by these people with open arms. You know, I mean, just, we were a hugging group, and here I seemed to be the only person who sort of had, like, I didn't have my act together, but I felt as if my act was a hell of a lot together. You know, I mean, I hadn't suffered. After about 3 months, I had recovered sufficiently. I think I recovered within about 3 months. I did the steps relatively quickly. I had a sponsor just got me through it. I took my first meeting. And I started that meeting off by saying, I have to apologize. I just haven't suffered that much, you know, and I sort of feel bad, but I guess all I can do is tell you my story, you know, and so I told my story. And around the room we go, and we went, and it fell to an old timer. I just blanked his name. He was the guy who used to be an AA as well as OA. As the bag was passed around, he said, "Put in what you can and take out what you need," which it's a very different world, you know. But at any rate, he said to me, "Laurie, I got to tell you, from those of us who have been in the gutter, you haven't missed a thing." So I really appreciate it. It was a great meeting that I went to. And it was on a Tuesday evening, and a number of us felt we'd love to have a meeting on a Friday to sort of in between, you know. So we set up a noon meeting, and it was a wonderful meeting. It was a free-form meeting. The meeting that we had on a Tuesday was had a set format. We in those days, we didn't have the OA 12 and 12. We read either from the AA 12 and 12 and some other, another book. And we would read them sort of in series and then begin again, and we'd talk about it, and sometimes we'd have speaker meetings, but that was basically the format. We decided we wanted to just have a sharing meeting, a smaller meeting where we could just, this is a big meeting, we wanted to have a sharing meeting where we could just talk about what's going on. So our format was relatively formless. It was the person who volunteered as chair for that day, for that meeting, would read any passage from AA or OA literature and comment on it. We'd go around the room and share. It was a fun meeting. We got a lot of really good sharing out. As a matter of fact, we enjoyed that meeting so much that most of us stopped going to the Tuesday meeting. And we just went to this Friday meeting. It was more convenient. It was it was lunchtime. We went out for lunch afterwards. We enjoyed ourselves. And the meeting began to die. People stopped coming to it. The meeting was close to my office. I set it up so it was close to my office. So I was always there. I had the keys, and I was always at that meeting. But people gradually began to die off. And I began to understand I wasn't in very good shape. I was OA at this meeting. I was the only constant at that meeting. And what did I have to offer when I was reading all this literature and talking about how wonderful OA is, when in fact I was gaining weight and clearly not in very good shape? And after a while, I decided the meeting had to close. So I did. I closed the meeting, there was no one else to close it, so I closed it. And I started to, and the Tuesday evening meeting had, I couldn't go to that one, but I went to another very strong meeting. This is a long way to tell an interesting story, but I went to another meeting that was full of recovery too. And people would say, "How are you, Laurie?" "Fine," I'd say. And they'd say, "Great. Great to hear you talk. You talk so well, you know." And, "Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I've had a good education. I've been gifted with a lot of training and experience. So, yeah, I talk well. Big deal." But, you know, "Fine," I'd say. "Great. Great to hear that, Larry. Keep coming back. You know, it's great to see you." One day, the shyest person in the room came up to me and said, before the meeting, said, "How are you, Laurie?" I said, "Fine." She said, "I mean, really." Whoa. I mean, I was like just a hit in the head. And I want to stop there and say, you know, there are all kinds of answers I might have given. I might have said, if I had been in a really terrible space, "How dare you take my inventory? How dare you imply that I am not recovered? If I say I'm recovered, I've recovered. I've made me physically not recovered yet, but I've recovered emotionally and spiritually and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Yada, yada, yada. I'm never going to talk to you again. I'm not going to come to this meeting anymore. You know, whatever." I could have said that. And if I had said it, I got to tell you, I think OA would have been in better shape in my hometown for a while, because I was no longer going to meetings talking about how wonderful this program was and obviously dying. You know? But I didn't. Instead, I said, "I'm in terrible, terrible shape, and I need help." And she spent an hour with me after the meeting, and she gave me something to read and something to hang on to. And I talked to her, I don't know if it was every day, but it might have been every day, but certainly I talked to her a lot. And she was my lifeline to recovery. It took a bit more than that, but it began my path to recovery, my openness, my willingness to be open. But the courage that it took her, I mean, I had not realized, it took me a long time to realize in OA, because there are so many women in the program, that I could be intimidating just because I'm a man. And because I speak with directness and a positiveness, and, you know, I don't mean positive, certainty or something like that, that I can be intimidating without even wanting to be intimidating. And I she told me later, and she's a very close friend of mine, we go to the same meeting, she told me how she had prayed so hard to figure out what she could be saying to me. For weeks she prayed to find the right words. And she didn't know what she was going to say, but the right words came out. And that's also what my experience has been for amends. I don't often know what I'm going to say, but I pray for the knowledge of what the right words are, and then they come out right. So tomorrow I'm going to talk a lot more about our message and how we comport ourselves as members of OA and why we are in existence. I'm going to suggest to you that Tradition 5 is the heart of all the other traditions, that the Tradition 5 is our primary purpose, is to carry the message to compulsive eaters who still suffer. It's not to feel good about ourselves. It's not to help other people who have recovered. It's not to spend time with our friends. It's not to be a support group. It is, in fact, to carry the message to someone else. And as long as OA does that, it deserves to live. And as long as, and when it doesn't do that, when it gives up on, if it ever, I don't think it ever will, but if it ever gave up on that primary purpose, it deserves to die, to let another 12-step group come up. Because there will never be an absence of 12-step groups dealing with food problems. Because I'm always going to be around, and all of you are going to be around, and we're all going to need to do step 12, or else we'll die. We're going to have to find someone who still suffers and help them. Because if we don't, and try to help them, because if we don't, we're all going to die. On that cheery note, I don't know how many of you, I'm sure many of you have seen Fiddler on the Roof, right? And you know the Tevye. Well, Tevye is a character in a number of short stories written by the guy was called the Jewish Mark Twain, Shalom Aleichem. And the stories are actually much deeper and much both funnier and also much more tragic than the musical is. Very deep. And there's one scene, and if you recall the scene in Fiddler on the Roof where he's saying goodbye to his daughter who's going off to Siberia to be with Felcher, whatever his name is, I think. Well, in that, the story goes, the story is told by his telling Shalom Aleichem the story. So it's all done in the first person, you know, well, Mr. Shalom Aleichem, this is what happened to me. So at the time that he's talking about, he's saying goodbye, she says, Papa, I'll never see you again, if you recall that moment. He says, and I haven't seen her. And then he says, and you see me crying. You hardly ever see me crying, Mr. Shalom Aleichem, but I'm crying now. You know what? Let's talk about happier things. What do you hear of the cholera in Siberia? Anyway, on that happy note, I'll finish up and I'll talk to you tomorrow about step 12. Thank you.
I'm Dina, compulsive over here, and we're going to try this again. I'm sorry about that. While she's pulling this, I've discounted the price on the lifelines out there, so they're only 50 cents a piece now. We like to sell them out.